I tell my people, I'm not your spiritual father anymore, I'm your spiritual granddad. So I'll still be around and still looking forward to it.
Perhaps the most well-known Catholic in America heads into retirement. Cardinal Timothy Dolan of New York sits down on the record with EWTN News In Depth to share wisdom from his many years as the Catholic leader of America's largest city. His thoughts on J.D. Vance, New York's new Democratic Socialist mayor, and passing the torch to a new archbishop. Mark Zuckerberg on the hot seat in court to answer whether social media is intentionally addicting our children. An expert weighs in on how to help children lead a healthier life. And an Augustinian friend of Pope Leo's joins us to discuss the meaning of the Pope's Lenten message, "Stop speaking harshly of your neighbor." EWTN News In Depth starts now.
Of course, you never retire from being a priest or a bishop. That people think that, and I'm always eager to clarify, no, you're a priest, you're a bishop forever.
One of America's most well-known Catholic leaders goes on the record with EWTN News In Depth. Cardinal Timothy Dolan joins us to talk about his life after retirement as Archbishop in New York City, his views on New York's new Democratic Socialist mayor, and his role on the Trump administration's Religious Liberty Commission. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. After nearly two decades as the Catholic leader of America's largest city, with his big gregarious personality and frequent appearances at high-profile national events, Cardinal Dolan just might be America's most familiar Catholic face. Just 2 weeks ago, there was a change at the top of the New York Archdiocese upon Cardinal Dolan's retirement. This week, he sat down with EWTN to share insights on some critical issues in the news and to reflect on what's next in his life with reporter Mark Irons. Here's Cardinal Timothy Dolan on the record.
I want to ask you, in a way, we're kind of entering a new era in New York City. Archbishop Hicks replaces
what a gem he is. One of the things that softened is a little sad retiring because I love the work. But as I mentioned to you, I tell my people, I'm not your spiritual father anymore. I'm your spiritual granddad. So I'll still be around and still looking forward to it. But one of the things that softened the sadness of retirement would be 17 happy years and a magnificent successor in Archbishop Ronald Hicks. He's a real gem. I've gotten to know him pretty well since I got the call that he was going to be my successor, and I admire him immensely.
Absolutely. And at the same time, we have a new archbishop in New York. We also have a new mayor, Zohran Mamdani. I think a lot of Americans, or perhaps some Americans, might have been concerned when they heard him self-identify as a democratic socialist. Mm-hmm. The second part of that title, socialist and democratic socialist, may be the reason some bristled at that title. You met with Mamdani before he became mayor. What can you share about that meeting? What is your takeaway after spending time with them?
Well, they ought to bristle if somebody identifies himself or herself as a socialist. That's not part of that's sort of the opposite of what America is. He's a refreshingly honest and approachable guy, and obviously a man of high ideals, some of which I would disagree with. I asked him point blank, I said, why did they say you're a socialist? He said, because I am. He said, now, I'm kind of an economic socialist, not a political one. Now, socialism is defined as what? Government ownership of the means of production. He says, I'm not that. He says, I'm an economic socialist in that I want greater distribution of the wealth. Well, who doesn't in one way? So let's see. So far, we were ticked off that he didn't, I was ticked off he didn't invite me to his inauguration. You know, most of the time the Archbishop of New York, among other religious leaders, gets invited. I was ticked off that he had few Catholics on his transition team. Okay. And then I was really ticked off that he didn't show up at the installation of my successor.
So what are those areas of conflict with someone like Mayor Mamdani? And are there areas of common ground that the church can work with?
Well, we would hope so. Yes, there should be. Well, areas of conflict we wouldn't know yet. Okay.
He has shown some opposition to some of those fundamental life issues the church is a champion of, it seems like.
Has he? We haven't seen much.
In terms of policy.
Work that he's done. But policy, what he professes, I'm afraid he would be an avowed a Democrat, meaning he's not pro-life, right? You worry, is he going to protect religious liberty? You worry if he's going to protect the dignity and the definition of the family. And you worry, too, but we may have some other areas where we're saying, hey, not bad.
Such as?
His openness to the immigrant, his desire for fair housing, his earnest desire to increase the income and the prosperity of most of the people in this town. If those are issues that he's favorable to, I'd say bingo. Let's go with it.
This month in the state, the Medical Aid in Dying Act was signed.
Isn't that, boy, you got right to bad news right away. We start off with good news.
We got to jump into
this
it.
This is bad, isn't it? You know, in what, am I shocked? You bet I'm shocked. Am I surprised? I'm not surprised. Mm-hmm. Because why should not the abortion capital of the United States, if not the world, New York, now become the euthanasia capital? If human life is cheap, if the dignity of the human person and the sacredness of the human life is not respected, especially when it's most vulnerable, the baby in the womb or grandma in hospice, if that's why would we not be surprised? Mm. If human life is thought to be burdensome, if its only value is that it's useful, or that it can produce, or that it's not inconvenient to me, we're in trouble. We're in trouble. Why do you think we have these shoot 'em ups? Why do you think we have violence on the street? You know what I'm saying? Because human life is so cheap. And now we got another example here in New York.
How would you grade one of the highest profile Catholic politicians in our country, J.D. Vance? What grade would you give him so far?
I've met him a number of times. He's a very good guy. I enjoy him a lot. I agree with a bunch of stuff that he talks about, you bet. I would sometimes say, uh-oh, can't agree with you there. He and I had a little tete-a-tete, you probably know, when he suggested that bishops in the United States were pro-immigrant because we were making money, which I said was not only untrue, it was scurrilous, and he apologized. All right, he says that was out of line and that's not true. So I think when he speaks about the family, when he speaks about babies, when he speaks about patriotism, when he speaks about what I think is a rather moving view of the beauty of what the United States stands for, I say bravo. Are there other things? I wasn't too happy with his views on Ukraine. This is before he was vice president. He was not too behind the Ukrainians. And so there you go again. You're not going to get anybody batting 1,000.
You yourself are on President Trump's Religious Liberty Commission. Uh-huh. I'm assuming you are happy with what you're seeing from the administration on that.
I'm happy with the administration that takes religious freedom very seriously, as I think he did. He's not the only one. We've had a Presidential Commission on Religious Liberty for quite a while. I'm not the first Catholic to be on it. I think at least for 30 years there's been one. So, but I'm very... very honored to be on that.
Sure.
So,
two concerns I hear Catholics bring up with the Trump administration. One being abortion pills. Now, the majority of abortions in the country come from abortion pills. That Catholics might ask, or anyone might ask, why hasn't the administration done more to limit access to abortion pills, to have restrictions or regulations? The second one being concerns about immigration enforcement carried out by the administration. Any thoughts on either one of those topics?
I'd be upset about both of those as well. So thanks for bringing them up. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you kind of coupled them together. Because, first of all, we are vigorously concerned about the dignity, the life of the baby in the womb. The more fragile a life, the more we want to protect it and guard it. So these abortion pills, they don't help. It not only is it bad in that it flushes away the tiny baby in the womb, it's bad because it kind of strengthens the opinion that pregnancy is a disease, that a baby in the womb is someone to get rid of if it happens to be inconvenient or untimely. So this is not all that good. Likewise, are we concerned about another group of fragile people, the baby in the womb? I don't mind telling you that on the religious freedom, all right, now most people are thinking, oh, I guess there's Catholics on the religious freedom. They got to support Trump all the time. Uh-uh. I don't mind telling you that Franklin Graham, who's not a Catholic, and I were very worried when I started going into churches and harassing churches. So we had here in the Archdiocese of New York that ICE would show up on Sunday Mass just in trucks and cars, and the people wouldn't come. They were
that scared. Was happening?
That was happening here. So I called Reverend Graham and I said, we need to bring up to the religious freedom that this is a violation of religious freedom. People have the right to worship on the Sabbath. The federal government cannot impede that or harass it, and they are. Franklin Graham wisely said, let's go, let's bring it to the attention of ICE, and we did. And the director here in New York said, thanks for bringing that to my attention. We're not going to do that here.
And are they stopping that?
I have yet to hear of any other pastor since then tell me that they're harassing or outside the churches. So you get my point. As you tied together two issues on the pro-life spectrum, I'm glad you did, because there's a lot of similarity there.
We talk about, you know, Catholic politicians. Let's talk about Catholic institutions. I'm not sure if you saw, but some of your brother bishops are calling for the rescindment of the appointment of Professor Susan Osterman. She was appointed to lead an academic department at the University of Notre Dame. Do you agree with some of those bishops that her appointment should be rescinded?
I would.
She was a pro-abortion advocate.
I would agree with him heartily. I would agree with Bishop Kevin Rhodes, who's the bishop there in South Bend. I would agree with Father Miss Campbell, who wrote an eloquent article. I would agree with a good chunk of Notre Dame alumni that this is an ill-advised appointment. Notre Dame is a light to the world, a salt to the earth, to use the words of Jesus. And it stands, again, for that double pillar of Catholic social justice, the dignity of the human person and the sanctity of human life. Anything that any university, particularly a prominent Catholic one, would do to dull that light to the world, we shouldn't do.
And Mark joins us now fresh from his trip to New York City to tell us more about his interview with Cardinal Dolan. Mark, great interview, newsy interview. Cardinal Dolan's never one to be shy.
Right.
But were you surprised with just how forthright he was?
I think to your point, yeah, we don't think of Cardinal Dolan as someone to hold back what he wants to share. But I got the sense that now that he's no longer Archbishop, maybe he was a bit more open and free with what he was sharing. And I mean, you look at the interview, a number of things he shared publicly we hadn't heard before, a lot of newsier things, talking about his honest reflections on Mayor Mamdani, his concerns about ICE violating religious freedom in New York, and then adding his voice to the growing number of bishops that are opposed to that appointment at Notre Dame, the pro-abortion advocate. So I think that there were a number of things there he shared that we hadn't heard, and Cardinal Dolan's always open to speak, and we know maybe more so even now.
Right, that was a packed interview. And your conversation was wide-ranging. And with Cardinal Dolan being one of the most prominent American Catholics, this is the 250th anniversary of our country's founding. You asked him to talk about and reflect on this moment of American Catholicism.
Right. And he's a great person to do it. I mean, Cardinal Dolan is an expert on Catholicism in this country. And I mean, and just so our viewers know as well, the conversation we shared there is about a third of our interview. The whole thing will be posted online. But we talked about a number of things, including that topic, American Catholicism. He wants to bring back some of the traditions that we had as Catholics, maybe going decades back that were more prominent, not just in this country, but in the church universal. Mm-hmm. But he also wanted to share some challenges we might face as Catholics in this country. I think we have a clip. Yeah. He shares something for us to remember as Catholics here.
While we want to kind of embrace what's good and beaming in the American culture, we also know that we're somewhat countercultural. Why? Because our true citizenship is in heaven. And Jesus, our founder, says, my kingdom is not of this world.
It's a great reminder from His Eminence. And while he's no longer Archbishop of New York, he's going to be staying busy.
As emeritus, yes, and he was actually just named the co-chief chaplain of the New York Police Department. We talked about that. And he said, you know, you can't be Archbishop of New York and not love the police, not minister to them, and he's going to continue to do that. He might have a little more free time. He did share some of his book recommendations. He's very well read. No surprise, the Bible and the Catechism are at the top, but also the Vatican II documents. There's a lot of commentary on what Vatican II was or wasn't about.
Right.
And he says, go to the sources. One of my favorite quotes from the interview, he said, read the Blumen documents. So we've got some homework to do. Check out the interview and read those Blumen Vatican II documents.
That's an emphasis of Pope Leo's right now as well.
It is.
Mark, great job.
Thank you.
And to see Mark's full conversation with Cardinal Dolan, go to EWTNnews.com/watch. Mark will be back with more from Cardinal Dolan and his report about last weekend's New York encounter. That and much more ahead on this edition of EWTN News In Depth.
I just know that more children have died since my daughter died in 2021, so things are not any better.
Do social media platforms deliberately cause addiction and harm children? Meta founder Mark Zuckerberg answers tough questions in a Los Angeles courtroom this week. That story plus expert analysis.
So it's so easy to forget the history. You know, history of human nature comes with the good, the bad, and the ugly.
A historical look at America's Black Catholic Church, moving with faith and resilience through the era of segregation as we mark Black History Month. And Pope Leo's Lenten message, refrain from harsh judgments in sharp and hurtful words. Love thy neighbor. EWTN News In Depth is coming right back.
In a sweeping ruling on Friday, the Supreme Court struck down President Donald Trump's far-reaching global tariffs. The long-awaited opinion delivers the White House a significant loss on a key part of its economic strategy. Trump imposed the tariffs last year on nearly all imports under the International Emergency Economics Powers Act, or IEEPA, a 1977 law that gives the president power to address foreign threats. The Treasury has collected more than $130 billion from the imported taxes. In a 6-3 decision, the High Court ruled the Constitution very clearly gives Congress the power to impose tariffs during times of peace, and there was no historical precedent to indicate otherwise. Chief Justice John Roberts authored the majority opinion. He writes, "The government reads IEEPA to give the president power to unilaterally impose unbounded tariffs and change them at will. That view would represent a transformative expansion of the president's authority over tariff policy." It is also telling that in IEEPA's half century of existence, no president has invoked the statute to impose any tariffs, let alone tariffs of this magnitude and scope. In his dissent, Justice Brett Kavanaugh noted that reversing the tariffs could mean chaos for the Treasury. He says, "The court says nothing today about whether, and if so, how, the government should go about returning the billions of dollars that it has collected from importers." Some companies like Costco have already lined up to get back the money they lost on the taxes. Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum were enacted under different laws and therefore remain in place. The White House can seek to reimpose the tariffs under other laws. A landmark trial this week in Los Angeles that questions whether tech giants Meta and YouTube intentionally make their products addictive. On the defense, star witness Mark Zuckerberg, Meta's CEO.
Mark, do you have a message to the parents?
Among those awaiting Zuckerberg's arrival were parents calling for accountability following years of concerns about the impact of Meta-owned Facebook and Instagram on youth mental health and self-esteem. In this trial, Meta and YouTube are accused of intentionally designing addictive features that hooked a now 20-year-old woman as a child, exacerbating her depression and suicidal thoughts. TikTok and Snapchat were also named in the lawsuit they settled before trial. Meta argues it was the girl's difficult family life, not social media, that led to her struggles. Victims' rights groups call the trial a historic moment in American law.
It was something that for years a social media company never thought would happen. They never thought that they would ever have to face a jury. They never thought that they would have to stand up and explain themselves under oath. Because they thought that through Section 230 they could avoid the liability and avoid the responsibility that every other company in America bears witness to.
Matthew Bergman, a lawyer representing some parents who say social media harmed their children, said it is his group's hope and expectation that the social media platforms of the future will be safer than the ones today. He said he expects this was only the first of several trials in which Zuckerberg will have to testify. To help us break down this landmark case and to discuss what it might mean for social media companies moving forward, we are joined by Claire Morrell, a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and its Bioethics, Technology, and Human Flourishing program. She's also the author of The Tech Exit, a practical guide to freeing kids and teens from smartphones. Claire, thanks so much for being with us. I first want to give our viewers even more context about what we know about social media and our youth. According to the U.S. Surgeon General's own advisory on the topic, children and adolescents who spend more than 3 hours a day on social media face double the risk of mental health problems. And when asked about how social media impacts their body, 46% of teens between the ages of 13 and 17 said it makes them feel worse. You know, Claire, you have said that we are arriving at big tech's tobacco moment. Are we finally about to see tech companies be held accountable for how social media has harmed children?
I really hope so. I mean, this is a landmark trial that we've even been able to get to this stage, that we're actually able to see the internal evidence that these companies knew that their products were harmful and addictive to children. They were actually designed to be addictive. And so this is really all the internal evidence coming to light through this trial has just been so clear that they knew. They have internal studies saying we make body image issues worse for 1 in 3 teen girls. They've done studies that have shown teens are not able to control their compulsive use of Instagram. They say they want to use it less, but they can't. And they've known this all along and continue to prioritize their profits over the safety of our children. And so I really do think this is their big tobacco moment in the sense that the evidence speaks for itself. And I really hope that the jury will make the right decision here.
And just to put a fine point on that, Claire, from Mark Zuckerberg's testimony, did we in fact get clarity on whether Meta created internal employee goals to make Instagram more addictive? He's previously denied that claim, but speak more about what we learned from these internal documents.
Yeah, so he had to take the stand in this case under oath and basically was presented with internal documents from the company showing that he specifically set targets. It was like a 2015 memo saying that he hoped to grow user time spent on the platform by 12% the next year. So it was a clear goal of the company to increase user time spent on the apps. And they specifically targeted children. Mm-hmm. Another internal study said to Meta internally, they said to their employees, the young ones are the best ones because they recognized the younger they can hook a user, the longer they can profit off of them over the course of their lifetime. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, during his testimony, he kind of tried to dodge these questions and sidestep them by saying, oh, well, we don't use these growth targets anymore, but could really present no evidence to back up his claim. And so I think just the disparity should hopefully be very clear to the jury between what he's saying and what the internal documents are really showing to be true.
That's pretty chilling. Claire, some of the most powerful voices calling for accountability are the parents who say that they lost their children because of social media. A group of parents spoke outside the courtroom this week, including this mother whose daughter died from fentanyl she bought from an older man on Instagram. Take a listen.
They were purposely and intentional decisions that were made to not change their platforms or make safety features available when they knew they had harms on their platform.
Claire, how critical are these parents' voices, and what do you want parents to know if their teens are using social media?
Yes, these parents' voices are really critical. They are so brave and courageous to step up and tell their stories because they don't want other parents to fall into the same pain that they have experienced of the losses and harms they've suffered from their children on social media. And I am grateful that they finally have their day in court, that finally these executives are having to answer for those decisions that harmed their children. And I would just urge parents to keep your children off social media until there is change, until there is real accountability, hopefully through this trial. Parents just need to know how harmful and addictive and dangerous these apps are. And I would, as I encourage in my book, The Tech Exit, parents to keep their children completely off social media. Yeah, just because of the level of danger.
Well, and on that note, Instagram says it does prevent children under the age of 13 from joining. But is that the reality of what's happening?
Not at all. And Zuckerberg was questioned extensively about this. You know, they say the age is 13. But if you go to create a social media account, all you have to do is enter a birth date, which is easy to falsify. There's no verification process. And then click a box agreeing to their terms and conditions. And so in a matter of seconds, a child can have a social media account, even if they're under the age of 13. And he was really questioned about this fact. And, you know, studies have shown 40% of 9 to 12-year-olds in the United States are on social media. social media. That's nearly half of preteens, and they're not supposed to have access. And so it is on the company. They need to be the ones enforcing the age gate on their platforms. And the reality is that they're not. And I think that they're not incentivized to, because they recognize this is a market for them to profit off of. Yeah.
Zuckerberg was also grilled about policies relating to cosmetic beauty filters on Instagram. What do we know about the harms of these filters? And they really disproportionately impact young girls, don't they, Claire?
They do. It's really sad. So these filters actually mimic plastic surgery. So Instagram actually put a temporary ban on the filters because they were told they're harming young girls, they're causing body dysmorphia and eating disorder issues. But then Zuckerberg and Adam Mosseri, the head of Instagram, chose to reverse that ban against the advice of 18 internal experts, all telling him that the research showed that these filters were harming young girls and their body image. And they chose to allow the filter anyway. And so I think that we really just have to see this for what it is. And he tried to kind of evade this answer on the stand as well by saying, well, you know, removing these filters would be overbearing. Yeah, that's really interesting spin. I think most parents would say it's a reasonable safeguard to remove such a dangerous filter.
Well, Claire, there's so much to discuss, but we'll leave it there. Claire, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Ahead, the British royal, formerly known as Prince Andrew, arrested and jailed in connection with sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. We approach the fourth anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine with no end in sight to the hostilities and Pope Leo's words of wisdom. We explore his Lenten message with another Augustinian who knows him well. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. The first arrest in nearly 400 years of a senior member of the British royal family tops news headlines in the Week in Review. The royal, formerly known as Prince Andrew, is the next major power player to fall in the Jeffrey Epstein pedophile scandal. Unmarked police vehicles descended onto the royal Sand Ingram estate Thursday morning to take Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor into custody on what happened to be his 66th birthday. British police did not say why he was arrested or outline any charges, but the former prince was a longtime friend of Epstein's, and he has been credibly accused of having sexual relations with underage females during their association. Now, new information released in the Epstein files indicates Andrew might have committed misconduct in office by sharing confidential trade information with Epstein while serving as Britain's special envoy for international trade in the early 2000s. Upon his brother's arrest on Thursday, King Charles released a statement saying the law must take its course and pledged his full support and cooperation with the police investigation. Andrew is but one of several major global figures implicated in the Epstein scandal in the last few weeks. Some face criminal charges, others have lost their high-profile positions. That's in direct contrast to what's happening in the U.S., where the Justice Department is not pursuing investigations against any perpetrators. Some members of Congress want action.
Look what the British government is doing in light of the evidence, and look what the United States government's doing. Nothing. Our chief law enforcement officer is defending and obstructing the investigation, Pam Bondi. And so it has been Congress in getting subpoenas and then passing bills and fighting to get this information disclosed. So it is refreshing that the British government is coming forward and actually, and the King is actually saying, we need to follow the law here. I wish our government were doing the same.
The former Prince Andrew was released from jail after several hours of questioning. It is not clear what will happen to him next or if he will be asked to come to the United States to answer questions about what he knows about others linked to the Epstein network. Some prominent Catholic voices are calling for justice for Epstein victims. Pro-life advocate Lila Rose was very active on her social media on this topic. On her X account, the founder of the pro-life group Live Action expressed shock that Epstein files have revealed some victims were as young as 11. In one post, she writes, "We need arrests." In another, she writes, "Every single person who harmed a child on Epstein's island should be in prison. A society that fails to protect its children has lost its moral compass." And pray for every child and young woman harmed by Epstein and other perpetrators. Their suffering matters. Their lives matter. Justice cannot be delayed. This Tuesday marks 4 years since Russia launched its full-scale invasion into Ukraine. In the past year, Russia killed more than 2,500 civilians, the highest civilian death toll of the war. Ukraine's power grid has been all but destroyed, leaving hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians without heat during a harsh winter. But Ukraine's spirit remains unbroken, and Russia's advances have been slow and costly. That's thanks in part to Western Europe sending weapons to Ukraine after the U.S. stopped sending aid, though military support from the international community declined overall in 2025. Ukrainian and Russian officials held a third round of U.S.-brokered peace talks in Geneva this week, but the two countries do not seem any closer to a ceasefire deal. Though the White House said meaningful progress had been made, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky claimed Russia was dragging out the negotiations while continuing to strike Ukraine. The previous meetings have produced agreements and prisoner exchanges, though no real breakthroughs. After another round of indirect talks, both the U.S. and Iran have signaled they are prepared for war if a deal cannot be made over Tehran's nuclear program. For weeks, the U.S. has built up military assets in the Middle East, and on Tuesday, Iran temporarily closed a key waterway for military drills in a show of force. President Trump said a nuclear deal might be made within 2 weeks. Iran's theocracy is in a precarious position after sustaining massive attacks on its nuclear sites from Israeli and U.S. forces last summer and for violently suppressing widespread protests earlier this year. A partial government shutdown seems likely to drag on as Democratic lawmakers and the White House show no sign of compromise over immigration enforcement reform. Funding for the Department of Homeland Security lapsed 1 week ago. Democrats have refused to advance funding for the agency since Customs and Border Patrol officers fatally shot a second U.S. citizen in Minneapolis last month. The shutdown impacts FEMA and TSA, but ICE and Customs Border Patrol remain largely funded thanks to the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. After being denied entrance last fall, Catholic priests were able to enter Chicago's Broadview ICE facility on Wednesday to administer Holy Communion and ashes. The priests minister to four detained individuals and three staff members at the facility. Their visit comes days after a judicial injunction required the Department of Homeland Security to grant clergy greater access to Broadview. In the evening, Chicago's Cardinal Blaise Cupich held an outdoor mass and procession through the streets of Melrose Park. Some 3,000 people, including family members of those detained, were in attendance. Elsewhere across the country, millions of American Catholics began their own Lenten journeys at their local parishes, including the one shown here in Arlington, Virginia. Crowds of faithful arrived for an early morning mass to receive the mark of ashes on their foreheads, a reminder that we are dust and to dust we shall return. The season of Lent is a call for Catholics to participate in Christ's death and resurrection by practicing prayer, fasting, and almsgiving. This Ash Wednesday was a special milestone for Pope Leo XIV, who began his first Lent as the successor of St. Peter. In his homily, he noted the distribution of ashes is an act that, quote, defies common sense and, at the same time, responds to the demands of our culture.
E sentire nelle ceneri.
Today we can feel in the ashes that are imposed upon us the weight of a world in flames, of entire cities disintegrated by war, the ashes of international law and justice among peoples, the ashes of entire ecosystems and of harmony among individuals.
The Holy Father also took part in a centuries-old tradition, leading a solemn procession from the Benedictine Basilica of San Anselmo to the Dominican Basilica of Santa Sabina, where he offered Ash Wednesday Mass. Santa Sabina is the first of 40 station churches in a special Lenten pilgrimage where the faithful are encouraged to visit a different church every day. The pilgrimage is inspired by the church's early martyrs, whom Pope Leo says shine as pioneers on our journey towards Easter. In his Lenten message, Pope Leo writes how Lent is a time of conversion through fasting, participating in community, and listening to the Word of God. True to his Augustinian roots, he turns to the Lenten insights of St. Augustine of Hippo. For more insight into Pope Leo's spirituality as we begin this Lenten season, we are joined now by an Augustinian priest and friend of our Holy Father's, father, Rob Hagen, is the prior provincial at the Augustinian province of St. Thomas of Villanova. Father, thank you so much for being here. This is the first time that we are seeing Pope Leo leave the church in the Lenten season. And I want to hone in on what seems really like a core part of our Holy Father's message for us, this Lent 2026, where he writes, I would like to invite you to a very practical and frequently unappreciated form of abstinence, that of refraining from words that offend and hurt our neighbor. Let us begin by disarming our language, avoiding harsh words and rash judgment, refraining from slander and speaking ill of those who are not present and cannot defend themselves. Father, I'd love to hear your reflections now on Pope Leo's invitation right there.
Thank you. It's nice to be with all of you today. It is a wonderful invitation. I don't know who said, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Because there could be not a more untrue statement than that. Words hurt, words matter, words divide. And so we have Pope Leo recognizing that and really calling us in this wonderful season of transformation and growth, really drawing upon St. Augustine's premise that when we fast in Lent, it has a lot to do with beyond fasting from food. And that might be a habit or a way of thinking. And so Pope Leo is challenging us to think about the way we speak, the words that come out of our mouth, and they're formed in the depth of our heart, and to be sensitive to disarming language, to language of kindness, to unity. And there could be no more need for that kind of devotion and commitment than that right now, absolutely, given the state of the world and our country, et cetera.
Yeah, words have consequences, like you said. And Father, one gift of Pope Leo's pontificate we're all learning about Augustinian spirituality. And Pope Leo quoted St. Augustine in his Lenten message with this line, quote, in the course of earthly life, it is incumbent upon men and women to hunger and thirst for justice, but to be satisfied belongs to the next life. Father, is there a specific Augustinian emphasis during Lent, a Lenten practice that's common among your Augustinian brothers, one you suspect is shaping Pope Leo's lens this Lent?
Well, as you know, as you may know, and people hear all the time when you hear any Augustinian refer to Augustine, our way of life, and that is the restless heart. We all have restless hearts, right? We're all hungry and thirsty for things that we think are going to satisfy us. And what Augustine kind of points to is it's like drinking salt water. The more we drink it, the thirstier we get. And so Lent and Augustine and Leo are challenging us to ask ourselves, what satisfies my thirst? What really satisfies my hunger? And so for Augustinians who are committed to the rule of Augustine, to obviously the gospel, you know, a lot of that starts with prayer. Augustine would say prayer is conversation with God. When you are in right relationship with God, it inevitably affects your thoughts, your words, and your actions. And when you're in right relationship with the people around you, it's then that we're at peace. It's then that we're satisfied. It's that kind of longing that can really only be filled by a relationship with God and the people around us. And so as Augustinians, you know, we're just like you all, you know, we need to kind of recommit ourselves to prayer, recommit ourselves to asking ourselves, what am I hungry for? What am I overly attached to? And then through the grace of God to maybe let some of those things go in favor of God's grace.
Yeah, we are not made for this world, that's for certain. I want to take a listen to part of Pope Leo's message for us from this Lent, from his Ash Wednesday general audience in Rome. Let's take a listen.
As we begin our Lenten journey today, let us ask the Lord to grant us the gift of true conversion of heart so that we may better respond to his love for us and share that love with those around us.
It is still stunning to hear the Pope speak in such perfect English. Father, later that day, during his homily on Ash Wednesday, Pope Leo referenced, we have entire cities destroyed by war right now. We are living in a world that is in flames. How do you expect we might see our Holy Father lead the church these next 40 days, especially amid such global conflict?
If he said it once, he said it 100 times, and I know he'll continue to say it and live it, and that is that we are all called to be peacemakers. And so, you know, not all of us are traveling the globe. Not all of us are entering into a lot of the politics, the world that, you know, is dividing us right now. But we all have an opportunity in our families, in our places where we work, in our neighborhoods, with strangers, with people who vote differently than we do, who people who look differently than we do, to build bridges, to be people who are extending not just peaceful words, but the kindness and the kind of love in action that our Lord calls us to. And as Augustinians, and Pope Leo has mentioned this before, that we are people of contemplation and then action. And so when we connect with the Lord, when we open our minds and our hearts up to God's grace, that's one part. But then we're called to go out into this busy world, this beautiful world, but this challenging world, and then to share those gifts in the orbit that we find ourselves.
We have to go to the Prince of Peace himself. Father, in my final minute with you, while I have you, I have to ask, you continue to also serve as the chaplain for the men's basketball program at Villanova. And it was recently announced that Villanova will tip off its next basketball season against the University of Notre Dame in Rome. Do you feel hopeful that Villanova alum Pope Leo XIV will be in the stands? What can you tell us about this?
Well, you know, it's just a wonderful opportunity for two wonderful schools with great traditions who have strong alumni bases and faculty and students and staff who are, you know, striving imperfectly as we are to live these values, to live our mission, and to come together, you know, in that venue and compete. And we're hopeful that our Holy Father will join us in some way. I don't know if he's going to be at the game, but I know that, you know, he's going to be praying, I'm sure, for both teams. And it'll be an opportunity for the two schools to come together to celebrate liturgy together, to really, especially in the state of sports these days, to really highlight those values of what makes a team a good team, unselfishness, and being part of something bigger than just yourselves. And so for us, you know, and Notre Dame to come together in that way in the Holy City, I think is a wonderful opportunity for all of us.
Absolutely, and we'll be watching. Father Rob Hagen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We'll be back in a moment.
We are a warm, friendly, welcoming church, and you get that when you enter, and it always has been.
Next, small but mighty. During this Black History Month, insights into an important Catholic constituency that has at times struggled to get its footing. Historical perspective plus celebration at the possibility of a new African-American saint.
What does it mean to be Black and Catholics? Catholic, it means that I come to my church fully functioning. That doesn't frighten you, does it?
An African-American Catholic is one step closer to sainthood. This month, the Diocese of Jackson, Mississippi, closed the first phase of the cause for canonization for Servant of God Mary Thea Bowman, a convert and Franciscan sister.
I bring myself, my Black self, all that I am, all that I have, all that I hope to become. I bring my whole history, my traditions, my experience, my culture, my African American song and dance and gesture and movement and teaching and preaching and healing and responsibility as gift to the church.
That's Sister Bowman addressing the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops back in 1989, the first African-American woman to do so. The granddaughter of a slave, she was born in Yazoo City, Mississippi in 1937. She converted to Catholicism at the age of 9 and joined the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration as a teen. A gifted teacher and singer, Sister Bowman spoke out against segregation and prejudice and shaped the U.S. Church's ministry towards Black Catholics. She died from breast cancer in 1990 at the age of 53. Her cause for canonization now heads to the Vatican. Like Sister Bowman, many Black Catholics throughout the history of the United States overcame prejudice and discrimination to answer God's call for their lives. Today, Black Catholics make up a small percentage of the U.S. Church. The latest and most comprehensive data is from Pew's 2022 study on Black Catholics in America. According to that study, there are around 3 million Black Catholics in the United States, roughly 4% of all Catholic adults. During this Black History Month, we take a renewed look at the history of the Black Catholic Church in one city in the American South. In this Catholic Life report, Roselle Regis traveled to Richmond, Virginia, to learn about the development of the church right after the Civil War in what was a segregated city.
For Black communities, faith is a huge part of who we are, and it connects directly to how we feel.
For some Black communities in Richmond, Virginia, the Catholic faith brings much joy. But for others, it has caused wounds that still need healing, with the root cause racism. Several Black churches and schools were closed in the 1960s to promote integration. But while intentions seemed pure, the outcome brought a lot of heartbreak. To pay tribute to the Black Catholics who have endured these challenges, Director of the Office for Black Catholics for the Diocese of Richmond, Virginia, Father Tochi Iwuji and his team created a museum exhibit called Faith and Resilience.
So we want people to understand the legacy of the Black Catholics in Virginia, but also to understand the power of faith as a source of empowerment. That during the time of segregation and social injustice, that faith was a refuge for the community.
Through artifacts and memories, people learned about historically Black Catholic parishes and schools that have shut their doors. The exhibit was displayed in the Black History Museum and Cultural Center of Virginia last fall. One of the churches that closed was St. Joseph's Catholic Church, among the South's earliest Black Catholic congregations.
That became a big deal in the 60s, late 60s, when it was closed. People felt terrible. People felt like their home was taken.
Its roots traced back to 1878, when then-Bishop John Keane wanted to spread the Catholic faith among the city's Black community.
He came here in 1878, and then he began to celebrate the sacraments and catechize the Black community during the segregation at the basement of St. Peter's.
When Bishop Keane saw that the congregation kept growing as the years went by, he established St. Joseph's Church and School on November 22, 1885, providing Black Catholics a place to worship freely. Monsignor Walter Barrett attended school at St. Joseph's. Like most of his peers, he was not a Catholic, but eventually converted after falling in love with the faith. In the third grade, he wanted to be baptized.
I approached the priest and I went to the rectory in St. Joseph's. And he said, "What do you want?" And I said, "Father, I'd like to meet with you because I want to discuss becoming a Catholic." And he said, "No." He said, "Too many of your people are leaving the faith."
But that did not discourage him from pursuing Catholicism.
It prepared me, I think, for the reality of being a member of a church with flaws, but that's also a church that's full of saints.
Today, this is what is left of St. Joseph's. A memorial park with its original bell in the center. Just miles away in the heart of the neighborhood known as Church Hill, another product of a closed church, is the oldest existing Black parish Holy Rosary Church. It started as a mission in the 1930s when the Redemptorist Fathers asked George and Deborah Pullard if they could use their home for prayer and devotion. Jocelyn Ford and her sister Joyce Ford are descendants of the Pullard family, and they are both proud to still call Holy Rosary their home.
I'm sure they had a lot of apprehension and a lot of fear, but their faith was stronger than the fear.
Holy Rosary is also where Monsignor Barrett was baptized, served as an altar server, and years later became pastor for 10 years. and where Father Tochi is now pastor. He sends a message to the Black Catholic community.
Even when life gets tough or when we feel deprived of an opportunity to just turn back to our faith and then let it nourish our resilience to understand that there will always be light at the tunnel, at the end of the tunnel, and that God will always be there.
Rosal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
If you would like to learn more about a proposed Black Catholic Museum in the Diocese of Richmond, visit the website of the St. John Newman Foundation at sjnf.org.
This weekend event attracts a wide range of people from all over the country. And one of the attractive things about New York Encounter is that it's free.
When we come back, reporter Mark Irons takes us back to New York City for a one-of-a-kind Catholic encounter that's reinvigorating the faith through dignity, truth, and forgiveness. That story next.
New York Encounter is an annual weekend gathering in the heart of Manhattan that has inspired the Catholic faithful for nearly 20 years now. Both repeat attendees and those coming for the first time say the discussions, exhibits, and performances renew and deepen their faith. Mark Irons shares their experience in this Faith Journey in-depth report.
Off the ever-busy New York City streets on West 18th Street in Manhattan, an encounter is underway.
The greatest gift that I have is the many friendships that I took away from coming to events like these.
Martin Simmons has been coming since his parents started attending years ago. This annual weekend event is called New York Encounter. It's open to anyone, young, old, families. It's free to attend. And it serves as a reminder that the faith can touch all aspects of life.
We're bringing Christ to the history of our world, to the state of our country right now, to science, to all of these things. It's not just within the theological context.
Speakers and exhibits address a wide range of relevant topics: art, science, history, technology, questions about justice and peace. Basically, all facets of life are on the table.
And is that something that's needed?
I think for sure it is needed.
That's according to college student and first-time attendee, Jonna Ribeiro.
We do a lot of dividing in our life. We have our prayer life, and we have who we are with our friends and at school. But, you know, Christ calls us to have Him as our metric of everything that we do. And that needs dialogue, that necessitates talking about it.
You'll find plenty of those conversations underway here, coupled best with an espresso, gelato, or sweet pastry, which was of great interest to me.
Any conference that has gelato has to be a good conference, you know? How much for a cannoli? Ooh, can I get like a handful of cannolis?
There's an Italian touch at this event, mainly because it's inspired by a Catholic movement started in Italy called Communion and Liberation, or CL. In Milan, a priest founded the movement in the 1950s. He was aware of Christ's presence in the wider world and culture, and especially in all people. His name was Father Luigi Giussani.
He could see Christ in all people that he met, so you were important to him. Because of your destiny. Your destiny is to be in touch with Christ.
Davide Prosperi had the chance to meet Father Giussani before he passed away in 2005. Now Prosperi is president of Communion and Liberation. He says at the heart of this now international initiative, relationship and friendship.
A proposal of friendship through which one is introduced to the life of Jesus Christ.
Encountering Christ through other people.
Yes.
Through community, through friendships. Do you find that here?
I do.
Like Martin, Betsy Nolan told us going the faith alone will be difficult.
It's not going to work out. No, it's not the optimal conditions for your faith to flourish.
She was a practicing Catholic long before joining CL, but the group has enriched her life.
Jesus said, go out in pairs. Where two or more are gathered, so am I there.
For those interested, local chapters of CL can be found around the U.S. Members find inspiration from the writings of Father Jasani and apply the Christian message to everyday living. While anyone is welcome and encouraged to attend this annual gathering, New York Encounter is something of a reunion for many CL members. And at the closing mass, you're likely to find a well-known cardinal.
You've been coming to New York Encounter for years.
I have.
Cardinal Timothy Dolan, recently retired from his role as Archbishop of New York, said Father Jasani provided the wise insight that faith isn't a small, squared-off area of our existence. Instead, it should offer an integrated, coherent vision of life.
Anything that enhances the human person, anything that promotes truth, goodness, and beauty is part of the Catholic vision. And anything we can do to enhance that and to strengthen that, let's do it.
At New York Encounter, family is valued and welcome.
We have this one and a couple more kids. They're running around doing things.
Space is set aside for kids. This year, they're working on a stained glass project. The colorful sections communicate beauty.
Is it cool to combine like an art project with your like Catholic faith?
Yes.
Why?
They go together well. I find art is a big part of the faith as well.
Attendees here find art or science to be complementary with faith.
I think that science is the language of God. Science explains the world that we live in, and God actually used this language of science to create the world, and this is another mean for us to discover him.
For Gianna, Christ isn't someone to put off in life, but someone to discover, to encounter now.
It's an invitation right now for everything to become more meaningful.
Everything can have meaning, including...
I'm going to have to do two scoops.
That dessert break.
Father Jasani would probably want us to have gelato. So much. I appreciate it.
Mark Irons, EWTN News In Depth.
And that's it for this edition of EWTN News In Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Join us again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.